Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, Biden's hopes for an ambitious agenda begin to fade. The president traveled to Europe this week to convince allies that, quote, America is back on the world stage. Here at home, Democrats have hit a roadblock. Since the election, congressional Republicans have made it clear their priority was stopping the administration. Still, Democrats with a razor-thin margin in the Senate held out hope they could pass sweeping new laws on things like voting rights and immigration, as long as they could convince West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin to vote with his party. This week, Manchin made it very clear he would not. The New Yorker's Susan Glasser writes the column, Letter from Biden's Washington. She joined me Friday morning. Susan, let's start with Senator Joe Manchin's op-ed last Sunday. What did he say, and what did you think of it?
Diane, thank you so much. It's so great, as always, to be with you. And I have to say, you know, watching the sport of watching Senate Majority Leader Joe Manchin, as he is often jokingly referred to these days in Washington, you know, the interesting thing about the op-ed in some ways is the reception that it got as much as it is the fact of it. Because the truth is, it was one of those news revelations in Washington that wasn't really news. In many ways, we've known for months that Joe Manchin was absolutely opposed to eliminating the filibuster, and also that he simply wasn't prepared to act on a number of crucial issues if there couldn't be at least some Republican support. So in that sense, we are just reconfirming something that we already knew. But I think the timing was such that with a number of other agenda items that are crucial for Biden's overall legislative success already also being stalled, and the sense that, you know, this kind of bipartisan era that we kind of knew wasn't going to happen, but nonetheless, you hope for it anyways. Seeing that it's not materializing, I think, crystallizes the moment. And so Manchin, once again, gets this enormous amount of attention. Although, by the way, he's not the only Democrat to balk at eliminating the filibuster. He's just the most prominent one.
Well, in addition to the filibuster, what about specific policies that Biden is trying to get through? What about the voting rights bill?
Well, that's right. I mean, that is a very sweeping response. It's called S1, you know, as in the first and most important priority bill of the Democrats in the Senate. And yet, this is something that Manchin is also opposed to. He says this is another example that he refuses to go along with a partisan solution to a partisan problem. And therefore, he says he has to have Republicans also on board with this. He favors a narrower set of voting reforms, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, which is a response to the Supreme Court decision a few years ago, essentially eliminating a key section of the Voting Rights Act that required preclearance in a number of states. This would resurrect that. Manchin is in favor of it, as, by the way, are many Republicans at the time said they would be in favor of this bill. And now they no longer seem to be in favor of it. And so, unfortunately, what you see is a kind of perpetual cycle of, well, we can't get any Republican votes, therefore we can't be bipartisan, therefore how dare you have promised us bipartisanship. And it's really a debilitating cycle, I think, that we're in right now.
Does this go to Mitch McConnell saying we're not going to allow any of Joe Biden's promises to become reality?
Well, that certainly seems to be the approach he's taken. And of course, it's very consistent with the approach that McConnell and Senate Republicans took to the Obama presidency. And, you know, I learned this in working on our last book, which is that if your subjects are telling you something over and over again, you should listen. And Mitch McConnell has been telling us pretty clearly what the strategy is here. I don't think it's a secret. And so at a certain point, we have to listen. And the question is, what are others going to do about it?
But Joe Manchin seems to be leading this, I don't know, group of Democrats who are beginning to hesitate about Biden's programs.
Well, I think different senators have different issues. Manchin, interestingly, is actually much more of an economic liberal than some of the other more middle-of-the-road Democrats. So he's actually more likely to go along with other aspects of Biden's program, perhaps, than some other wavering Democrats. And, you know, I think it reflects, though, this is a small, small number right now in the middle, and that overall is a big part of the problem. So, you know, in the Senate, in the old days, you know, when I was just a kid and coming to Washington in the late 1980s or early 1990s, you know, there was a huge chunk, maybe not half, but say 20 senators who were in the middle. Many of them represented states that had gone in the other direction at the presidential level. So it was still possible in America for people to split their tickets. And right now, Joe Manchin is a huge outlier, right? West Virginia is an enormously Republican state, enormously pro-Trump state in the last two elections, and yet Manchin was able nonetheless to win. He's essentially a unicorn. He's a one-of-a-kind type category in this day and age. And so partially, I think, the inability to come up with deals is because there's no pressure on senators anymore to operate across party lines.
So what is it that's driving Manchin? Is it self-interest as a Democrat coming from a Republican state?
Look, all of these senators, in my experience, are driven by self-interest, among other complicated issues. Clearly, Manchin is a guy who seems to enjoy the spotlight a bit. And like I said, it's not maybe an accident that he is getting so much more attention as a Democratic outlier than some of the other Democrats who also are not in favor of getting rid of the filibuster. And that is not a group of just one, is not a group of just two. Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona is the other Democrat who's often mentioned in this group, but it's actually more than them. It's not a ton, but it's a handful. And I do think that the fact that Manchin gets so much attention obviously has something to do with the man himself.
What can President Biden do with Joe Manchin?
Well, as I said, the prospects become a little bit different when you look at some of the more substantive pieces of his agenda. For example, Manchin generally is in favor, as Democrats and Republicans before him have been, on investing in and building up federal programs, because West Virginia is a very poor state. I'm expecting that if there is ultimately an infrastructure deal, that obviously Joe Manchin is highly likely to be in favor of it and to other aspects of the program like that. I don't think you're going to see Joe Manchin saying, well, I can't support any kind of tax increase whatsoever. Now, you might see some other Democrats saying that, but I don't think you'll see Manchin saying that. So again, I think the record is a little bit more mixed when it comes to substantive legislation, but at this basic issue of kind of the organization of our government and what kind of crisis our democracy is or isn't in, that's where you see the two parties at loggerheads and Manchin kind of in the middle of it.
How would you describe the state of our democracy right now?
Diane, you know, it's pretty terrifying, isn't it, when the Congress of the United States is attacked in this manner for the first time in such a way since 1814, and they can't even agree on a bipartisan commission to investigate it, as we have had with all other recent national events of such import. It just blows the mind. And the revisionism and the conspiracy theorism and the anti-democratic small d measures that I see taking hold in, you know, not the entire Republican Party, but a key subset of it, is very worrisome. There's a poll out this week, Diane, and I know every week we can talk about this, but there was one that just caught my attention this week. 53% of Republican voters, 53% believe that Donald Trump is the, quote, true president of the United States to this day. And yes, our democracy is in crisis, people. This is a crisis.
Exactly. And how many of those polled believe he's coming back in August?
Well, I think it was something like a third or more of Republican voters. And again, this is a completely bogus new thing that Trump is saying. What strikes me is that, of course, at the national level, when people like Kevin McCarthy and Elise Stefanik amplify Trump's lies and false statements, they know better. And they're in a sense, gaslighting America and, you know, telling their people what they think they want to hear. What's amazing is that they're able to convince so many millions of Americans of things they themselves know to be farcical and untrue. And it's this fetid swamp of, you know, conspiracy theories and lies and misinformation that so many people have willingly gone into, I think, that really constitutes the crisis for democracy. Because, you know, in the end, you know, you have to have certain basic principles and facts agreed to on the public square. And that's where I think there's such a definitive break with our recent past.
Going back to Joe Manchin, does Joe Biden have any strength of bargaining power with him?
Well, look, I think that, you know, maybe some Democrats were in a little bit of a fantasy land of, you know, imagining, you know, the second coming of FDR and LBJ and, you know, embracing after 4 years of Trump the, you know, the sort of joy of having a president willing to use his bully pulpit to advance sweeping progressive ideas. But come on, you know, like, math is math, folks. You know, a 50-50 Senate is what it is. The biggest, likeliest possibility is that the 50-50 Senate might not even last. The Senate Democratic majority might not even last till the next election. That's exactly what happened the last time there was a 50-50 Senate. Ask George W. Bush what kind of sweeping agenda you can enact with a 50-50 Senate. And come on, who was deluding themselves? And frankly, that's the left's version of lying to yourselves and believing it. If the right's version right now is to lie to yourself and believe that there was some fraudulent rigged election, there's been an element of that on the left as well. The fantasy version of thinking that you can enact LBJ-style transformational legislation in a 50-50 Senate. They were selling a bill of goods to people who seemed to be willing to believe it.
So with his vow, that is, Manchin's vow not to get rid the filibuster. What does this mean for the rest of Joe Biden's agenda?
Look, I think the key test, and obviously one that's being so closely watched right now, is in fact these negotiations over the infrastructure bill. And the reason I say that is because that is something that has historically been extremely popular. Even Donald Trump not only pledged but failed to pass an infrastructure bill, but talked about spending large sums of money on it, and in theory was in favor of something not that dissimilar, I suppose, to what this bipartisan group of senators is now talking about doing, less than Biden's much more sweeping bill. But nonetheless, the reason I think this is crucial to tell us whether any legislation can be passed in Washington anymore, aside from, you know, with sort of gun to our heads tragedy like COVID pointed at us, is because, again, spending the government's money to improve the country is literally like the definition of what used to be popular pork barrel spending among both parties. And right now, Republicans as well as Democrats claim to be in favor of it. And so I'm looking at that because if they can't come up with an agreement on some package, even if it's not everything that both sides wanted, that used to be understood that that's how compromise works. And my fear is that both parties will see too much incentive in simply having something, an issue to campaign on, to actually say, well, hey, we'll take what we can get now and keep working on the rest. And that is literally the difference that I see between now and what used to be. It's not like the past was some great era. It's not like, you know, 1980s Reagan era Washington was so wonderful. It certainly was a partisan time. It's not like you had to idolize Ronald Reagan to say, like, hey, there was Democrats and Republicans who saw an incentive to cut a deal. And I worry that if they can't do that on infrastructure, I think it suggests we're in for really, really rough times ahead.
The deal Republicans offered is so much less than what Biden wanted.
So one deal that you're talking about, which was offered by Manchin's West Virginia colleague, Shelley Moore Capito, now she was negotiating on behalf of the Republican leadership. And that collapsed because Biden said no deal, too far away. And what has happened this week that's interesting is that the baton has now been picked up by a bipartisan group of senators. And they are moving the ball, I would say, incrementally down the field, right? So they actually are in favor of more spending. I think the issue is remains the sticking point over how it's going to be paid for. And those Republicans are still adamantly opposed to new taxes and, in fact, are proposing some kind of payments that the Biden administration has categorically ruled out.
Leftover money from the COVID vaccine.
Well, that's part of it, is leftover money from the COVID relief package, the $1.9 trillion relief package that was voted on in the early days of the Biden administration. The other issue that's come up is, I believe, a gasoline tax, which is something that has also been proposed by this new bipartisan group of senators.
And what about taxes on the wealthy?
Well, exactly. That's the key part of the Biden proposal, and that's where we haven't seen Republican movement at all. But the Democrats and Biden are sticking pretty firm on this. And, you know, it won't surprise you to know that this is actually extremely popular among Republicans as well as Democrats. And that's one of the reasons why you're seeing the administration stick firmly on taxing wealthy corporations. Because, you know, this is a populist moment on the right and the left. And although, you know, Trump talked a populist game because that was what his voters wanted, he didn't actually deliver a lot in terms of an agenda for people like that. But if you ask them, you know, would you like to, you know, screw wealthy corporations? Guess what? You know, there's a lot of people in America of left and right who think that, you know, inequality is out of control in this country and that corporations and wealthy individuals are not paying their fair share.
So would the taxes on wealthy corporations go along with taxation of wealthy individuals?
Well, that's a good question. Of course, you know, there was this major disclosure this week by the news organization ProPublica that showed that, you know, many of America's wealthiest tycoons, people like Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk, are paying little to no taxes, as my husband said, a lot less than we are, that's for sure. And that's the kind of thing that just frankly enrages Americans, and potentially justifiably so. You'll remember it kind of got lost, unfortunately, in the, you know, the flood of election news and COVID news last fall. The New York Times showed that Donald Trump, a wealthy man, as he liked to brag over and over again, paid little and zero taxes in many of the previous decade before he became president of the United States. Imagine that, a man who brags about being a billionaire who pays $0 in taxes. So, of course, this is a key part of the Democrats' agenda. And I think if they could get it passed, they know that Republican senators might be opposed to it, but and Republican big money givers might be opposed to it, but that everyday Republican voters are unlikely to be offended.
More of my conversation with Susan Glasser when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Susan Glasser. She's a staff writer at The New Yorker who writes the column, Letter from Biden's Washington. How much of Biden's plans can be passed through reconciliation?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, you know, we're all learning a lot about the arcana of Senate rules this year because of the 50-50 Senate. And, you know, already it looks like they're going to get not just one shot, which is typical, but, you know, two. The question is, I think the parliamentarian may object if they try to do this more. Essentially, you know, this is a tool of being making sure that the Senate is able to pass the regular budget, which is a key part of its constitutional responsibilities. All right. Congress is the pocketbook. And, you know, so that can be stretched, but it can be stretched also beyond the breaking point. So I'm dubious that you're going to get more than one more big shot at this.
Like what? On what bill?
Well, Bernie Sanders right now, who is the chairman of the Budget Committee, as I understand it, is proceeding to mark up something that could become essentially the umbrella omnibus bill. And you could put in parts of the, I guess, what Biden is calling the American Family Plan and the American Rescue Plan. So, you know, you could load it up with a lot of stuff, but you might not get another shot after that.
Whoa. So taxation would go into that, raising gas prices would go into that. Infrastructure could go into that.
I think that's right, Diane. And again, I don't want to say something wrong because I'm not an expert on the arcana of Senate rules right now. But I believe that is the plan B, to the extent there is a plan B, if plan A, which is to say a bipartisan deal in regular order, fails.
Now, I want to turn to the president's trip abroad. How did he do in England?
Well, you know, the President Biden obviously is off this week, maybe happily away from these negotiations on Capitol Hill, although still in contact, I'm sure, about them. This is Biden's debut on the international stage, and it's very significant, I think, that he's chosen to visit Europe as his very first international trip, a stark contrast, obviously, in every way to Donald Trump, who made the very unusual and even bizarre decision for an American president to have his very first foreign visit overseas be to the unfree kingdom of Saudi Arabia. You remember the sword dance and the glowing orb. You know, this is the exact opposite of this. And the message here, of course, is America is back. We are reconnecting with our European allies and partners. And Biden has really increasingly come to frame his foreign policy in these stark terms of, you know, it's a key moment in the world when the Western democracies are being challenged as never before by resurgent autocracies, China and Russia. We've got to get our act together and work together, democracies, if we're going to have a meaningful response to this challenge from China in particular. So that's the overall messaging. You know, summits are usually about messaging in many ways and about politics and optics. And so in that sense, I think, you know, there was a low bar for Joe Biden to to jump over because these folks, these European partners were, you know, frankly, exhausted and terrified by Trump over the last 4 years. He kept threatening to blow up their alliances. He offended them personally. He walked out of a NATO meeting at one point and said he was going to potentially withdraw the United States from the alliance that the United States created. He blew up a G7 communique in Canada a couple years ago because he was mad at something that Justin Trudeau said in a press conference. So, you know, this was always going to be a low hurdle in that sense for Joe Biden to overcome. And the start of the trip was all about bonding with the allies. And so, you know, we'll see next week in Geneva when he meets with Putin. That's the tougher part of the journey.
Having talked earlier about what's happening here in this country, how does that affect his standing as he meets with Putin?
You know, Diane, I think that really is the key thing. And I think Biden, by the way, gets this. It's a little bit hard to be selling his allies on standing up for democracies and how we have to rally democracies together when he can't convince half of Americans themselves to stand up for American democracy. And, you know, Europe has gotten an enormous scare, I think, over the last 4 years, not just from the man Trump, you know, his quirks one way or the other eventually will disappear from the stage, but from the idea not only of Trumpism, but of the idea that America might not be the stable, constant partner that they came to expect, and that American leadership is not something to be taken for granted. So I think there's an enormous concern that, you know, Biden is rejoining multilateral organizations like the World Health Organization. He's rejoined the Paris Climate Accord. He wants to do international deals on things like vaccines, providing them to poorer countries, working together with other countries. But You know, who's to say that Trump or someone like him won't be back as president in just not even 4 years and is going to rip up a new Iran deal, is going to rip up the Paris Climate Accord again. And so Vladimir Putin sees all this, and this is, you know, frankly, his dream scenario. So the more uncertainty there is about American democracy, the more that Putin benefits.
What is Biden hoping to accomplish with Putin?
Well, I think that is the question. There's a lot of controversy, really, among Russia watchers in both parties, Democrats and Republicans, about was this the right time to have a meeting with Putin, given how many provocative and aggressive actions he's taken. Obviously, it wasn't just investing in Donald Trump and election interference in both 2016 and 2020, but this series of cyber hacking inside the U.S. by Russian government entities and also by Russian-affiliated criminal groups has continued to this day. And, you know, you see 100,000 troops that Putin sent to the border of Ukraine as if he was, you know, using them as leverage to get this summit. Not only is he imprisoned Russia's leading dissident, Alexei Navalny, just this week in advance of Biden's summit, he banned Navalny's organization altogether, which is to say one of the most significant moves to stifle any kind of opposition in Russia that we've seen. If that's not a provocation to the American president, I don't know what is. And so what is Biden possibly going to hope to get out of this? Right now, they're just frantically lowering expectations, I would say, for the meeting, and hoping that it's enough to have the meeting to head off any future big Putin eruptions.
What kinds of threats can Biden make toward Putin in terms of the cyber hacking that's gone on, the imprisonment of Navalny, and two other Americans being held in Russia? What kind of threats or power or leverage can Biden hope to have?
Well, you know, Diane, that is the good question, because first of all, there is a lot that we can do. Even this endless rounds of sanctions that we've seen since 2014, you know, I'm told very reliably, you know, there are much tougher measures that we could take but have never taken that would hit Putin and his inner circle much more directly, for example. There are things that we could do. I think the issue is that Putin has assessed, and in my view, probably correctly assessed, that we might not be willing to threaten them because our credibility is on the line and he doesn't think we'll follow through. And, you know, that's the risk factor here. In the end, Putin has behaved like a terrible bully in his own neighborhood with his neighbors, Ukraine, Georgia. He's invaded both of them. The Baltic states obviously are in a state of permanent high alert when it comes to Putin. Poland, same thing. And yet, in the end, it is Putin's neighborhood, and I think it's this balance between U.S. credibility. We don't want to be out there threatening actions that we're unlikely to follow through on.
Is Putin himself in any kind of fragile situation?
You know, Diane, I think that is a good question. So the answer is, of course, yes. And Putin has domestic politics. We often refer to him as an authoritarian, as an autocrat. He is those things. But every society, even an autocratic society, has politics. And as the rallies around Alexei Navalny's imprisonment suggest, you know, there is a meaningful opposition to Putin, even a generational opposition to Putin. He's now been in power for more than 20 years, the longest serving leader since Joseph Stalin of Russia. There's an enormous fatigue with him. It is widespread now, beyond even, I think, the big cities like Moscow and St. Petersburg that for a long time were the centers of dissidents to Vladimir Putin. Frankly, by making these threatening moves internationally, by getting an international summit with Biden, Putin has distracted to a certain extent from his domestic woes and from his potential weakness at home.
Is there any chance that huge crowds pro-Biden could turn out?
Well, that's a good question. I think that there's a very big wariness in the U.S. in being seen to be acting on Putin's internal political situation. That has been not only a red line for Putin, but an obsession of his. This idea that the United States is fomenting some coup, some color revolution to take him out. Remember, all those years ago, that was exactly what Vladimir Putin accused Hillary Clinton of when she was Secretary of State under Barack Obama. So I think you'll see a big wariness. The United States, speaks out in favor of human rights in Russia, in favor of, you know, better conditions for people like Navalny. But it's a fine line because I don't think it helps the dissidents inside Russia for Biden or the U.S. to be seen as funding or directing their cause in any way.
Susan, thank you, as always.
What a delightful conversation, Diane. You are the best interviewer, hands down.
That was Susan Glatzer, staff writer at The New Yorker. Her latest book is The Man Who Ran Washington, which she co-wrote with her husband, Peter Baker. And that's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Michael Kitt. Thanks for listening, all. Be well, stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.